Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Melanie, and I'm reading the Big Bend Sentinel, August 5th, 2020. Three Presidio residents lose their lives to COVID-19, by Abby Perot. Presidio County. On Friday, Presidio County marked a tragic milestone, recording its first COVID-19-related death. A Presidio resident passed away in an Odessa hospital's COVID-19 unit. Within 24 hours, a second Presidio resident would succumb to the disease. By Monday, a third had died. For over 4 months, the county had been able to avoid the deadly impacts of COVID-19, even as neighboring communities have seen higher case counts and the fatalities from COVID-19. Yet, as state data reports that Presidio County's total case count has only reached 44 cases compared to Brewster County's 186. Presidio County now has the most deaths in the Tri-County area and a 6.8% death rate. The deaths were reported by hospitals in the region, and Dave Culberson, the program manager for the Department of State Health Services Region 910 Epidemiology Program, confirmed those deaths as Presidio residents. The first, a 91-year-old male from Presidio, was admitted to Medical Center Hospital in Odessa on July 28th and died the afternoon of July 31st. The second life lost was a 72-year-old male from Presidio who passed away at Odessa Regional Medical Center on Saturday, August 1st. 2 days later, on August 3rd, a 41-year-old male and relative of the 72-year-old died at MCH in Odessa. He had been battling COVID-19 at Medical Center Hospital since July 21st. Even as deaths have risen, the number of active cases has declined in the counties of Presidio and Brewster. In data provided by the county judge's office, which varies slightly from state-reported data at this time, only 14 of Presidio County's 43 cases remain active, with an even split of 7 active in Marfa and 7 active in Presidio. Overall, Marfa has 22 cases, 2 ahead of Presidio's 20. This week, Shafter recorded its first case, which is still active. Compared to Ojinaga's 142 confirmed cases and Brewster County's 185 cases, Presidio County's case count is comparatively small. Looking at it per capita, Ojinaga records 5 cases for every 1,000 residents, and Presidio County is around 6 per 1,000, while Brewster County has almost 20 cases per 1,000 residents. But all of these numbers are largely affected by testing, which has been hard to quantify by county, in part due to residents traveling to testing sites in neighboring counties to get swabbed. Ample available testing helps confirm the existence of cases with fewer symptoms, and when people know they are positive, they are better able to stop the spread to more vulnerable community members. Recently, free testing sites have come to the area about every 2 weeks, and those hoping to get tested in the meantime have to rely on local clinics. County Emergency Management Coordinator Gary Mitschke is optimistic about residents getting tested, though. While previous sites saw around 180 tested over a 2-day period, the latest testing site on Monday saw 311 area residents arrive to be tested, the most attendees in 1 day at any Marfa site. In her announcements of deaths, Judge Cinderella Guevara continued to encourage hand-washing, sanitizing, avoiding touching your face with unwashed hands, avoiding contact with people who are sick, staying home when you are sick, covering coughs and sneezes, practicing social distancing by staying at least 6 feet away from others, and staying at home to stop the spread of coronavirus. In Texas, Hispanics and Latinos are 38.2% of the state's population as of the last census. State data also reports that Hispanics comprise 39.9% of the state's COVID-19 cases that have been investigated. That is, added to the database with gender, age, and race and/or ethnicity data. But the state data also reveals Hispanics are disproportionately dying from the infectious disease, accounting for 50.8% of all fatalities that the state has investigated. A toda la gente bonita de Presidio, Presidio Mayor John Ferguson wrote to address his constituents. the beautiful people of Presidio this week in Spanish. He announced the three COVID-19 fatalities the small border community has experienced. The statement told Presidio residents that it's important to keep a healthy distance, use face coverings, and avoid parties and pachangas. The danger of coronavirus has not decreased, he said. Marfa City Council signs off on local contact tracing efforts by Stephen Paulson. Marfa. Marfa City officials are moving ahead with plans for local contact tracing. At a City Council meeting on Monday night, the Council voted unanimously to approve such a program. Local contact tracing efforts, coupled with state ones, are already the norm in places like Houston and Corpus Christi, where the existence of city and county level health departments make it easier for health officials to coordinate the state and local level. But Marfa's contact tracing initiative would be a first for small town rural Texas, leading some city leaders to dub it a pilot program. Monday's vote was the latest development in what's been a long journey for advocates of local contact tracing. After hearing conflicting reports on Texas's contact tracing efforts, Marfa City officials have spent weeks figuring out the logistics of local contact investigations. Buck Johnston, a city council member who is taking a leading role in those efforts, said she first floated the idea of contact tracing in March, but the issue ended up on the back burner as Governor Greg Abbott took over more control on the local level and passed rules limiting the decision-making powers of city and state county officials. Still, the lack of local control over issues like public health and safety left Johnston and others looking for alternative ways to help the community. And as it became clear that Texas contact tracing efforts were floundering, they began to work to get a local contact tracing program off the ground. I'm really excited, Johnston said in an interview Tuesday after City Council's vote. This is something that we can do to protect our small little town. For a while, Marfa contact tracing program seemed far from guaranteed. County leaders said the program likely wouldn't be feasible, citing conversations with state officials and ethical concerns with Marfa's tracing friends and neighbors. But city leaders were hearing otherwise, including Buck Johnston, who solicited the advice of Dr. John Carlo, a Dallas-based doctor and member of the state coronavirus task force. He said he saw no reason why Marfa couldn't establish a contact tracing program. City Attorney Teresa Todd heard the same from the office of State Senator Jose Rodriguez and particularly his chief of staff, Sushma Smith. Smith helped coordinate a meeting between local officials and DSHS higher-ups who ultimately gave the program the green light. It got another boost on Monday when City Council also unanimously approved the program. Johnston, who's researched the issue, told the council Marfa could likely pay for local contact tracing through Texas Division of Emergency Management funds. With that city decision now reached, Todd will take that answer to state health officials, who have said they'd figured out the final logistics once Marfa leaders gave the go-ahead. Barring some sudden and unforeseen changes, and in the Texas coronavirus response, there certainly have been a fair number of those, that means Marfa will likely get a contact tracing program. Marfa City Council meeting also offered more details on what the local contact tracing program would look like, and rather than just using data from the DSHS, it'll likely work on collaborative basis with state officials. After all, city leaders have argued the state has a range of resources they don't have, including connections to emergency aid and counseling. But Marfans are better in touch with the situation on the ground, including information on where people actually live in a town where almost all mailing addresses are P.O. boxes. The city will likely put out ads asking people to contact them if they've had positive test results or symptoms. The city will set up a number not only for outgoing calls, but for incoming ones. And ideally, it'll be a local number staffed by contact tracers who officially work for the city. The city wants to hire 1 to 3 people for the role. And at press time, 2 candidates have been publicly announced. First, as the Big Bend Sentinel previously reported, there's Don Culbertson, a physician's assistant at Marfa Clinic who also helped jumpstart the possible Marfa contact tracing program and would likely run it. He previously worked as a contact tracer in Washington State and has received contact tracing training from Johns Hopkins University. This week, city officials also announced that they were considering Letitia Letty Garcia, a medical assistant also at Marfa Clinic, for the role. Although she hasn't yet trained in contact tracing, she's worked with Child Protective Services, which city officials say has an overlap. With my prior work as a social worker, it all ties together, Garcia said in a phone interview on Tuesday. As a caseworker, she also did wellness checks, conducted investigations, and helped families find resources, she said. Marfa's contact tracing program could still see challenges, though. For one, Dr. J.P. Schwartz, who serves as a local health authority and could help facilitate communication between Texas DSHS and Marfa contact tracers, is technically a county official. With Marfa the size it is, he also happens to be Culbertson's colleague at the Marfa Clinic. We work together all the time, Schwartz said. They already have work rapport, and Schwartz supports the idea of local contact tracing efforts. Still, Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara has said that the city would need to get approval to use Schwartz, a county official, in his official capacity during any non-county coronavirus response. Guevara was not available to comment by press time for this particular issue. Otherwise, the city would need to find its own health authority, which appears to be another legal option, according to the Texas Health and Safety Code. Another issue is problems with state data. Both Schwartz and Culbertson said they'd learned more about the scope of the virus in Marfa from talking to patients than from reading state reports. In one case, Culbertson told City Council, a patient received positive results, went through quarantine, and was released before ever hearing from state health officials. I felt like a congressperson getting a redacted version of the Mueller report, he said of state data, which is funneled from the state to county officials before being released in public news releases. There's a backlog on that information on a state level, and the information that does get released, as Culbertson put it to council, isn't particularly useful. That's why Marfa officials think it won't just be tracing off-state data, but finding their own cases and adding to the state rolls. In an interview Tuesday, Culbertson said he was happy about the new program. People don't need to feel ashamed or self-conscious or judged for having COVID, he said. All we are trying to do here is prevent the spread, and it really is spread innocently and invisibly. After the council's decision, Culbertson said he considered celebrating. Then he decided he didn't have anything to celebrate. We got invited to the race, but we don't have a car yet, he said. That's what we're working on now. Take 2. New City Ordinance on Film Productions is Put into Action by Abby Perot. Marfa. Film crews are already putting the new City of Marfa Film Ordinance and Filming Guidelines to the test, less than a month after City Council put it into effect. Exotic Creatures Film Production arrived to shoot a short film for an online video streaming service. Last week, a small production filmed actors and B-roll on city sidewalks for an hour. But this is the first real robust one, Community Services Director Mandy Rowan said about the shoot that shut down parts of Highland Avenue on Monday and filmed around town on Tuesday and Wednesday. On set, a sizable crew of at least 10 filmed an actor in a vest, boots, and a cowboy hat as he leaned against a truck with the cage in the back, and a woman in a crisp white button-down with the sleeves rolled up and tucked under a belt buckle leaned her hip against the tailgate talking to him. However, details are slim on what the film is about, and a producer listed on the city's permit kept mum about the project, hoping to provide more publicity next month. Rowan was told the project shot in Marfa was the pilot, but then they'll be doing some other kind of iconic locations. One new aspect of the city ordinance is an increase in fees for filming in Marfa, which were previously negligible. Filmmakers will now pay $250 for the permit and incur additional costs for use of city property. For a complete road closure, like the one on Highland Avenue near the courthouse, that stopped traffic in both directions, those additional fees look like $150 per block, per hour of shooting. Despite filming in Texas, the crew on this project hailed from New Mexico, where film productions are temporarily halted due to COVID-19. According to the New Mexico State Film Office, the health safety of our citizens and workforce is of paramount importance, and the governor has not yet greenlit a date for a safe production resumption. When production resumes, the New Mexico Film Office will release recommendations that have been shaped by experts, and are in alignment with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers Industry-Wide Labor Management Safety Committee Task Force. Industry-Wide Labor Management Safety Committee Task Force proposed health and safety guidelines for motion picture, television, streaming productions during the COVID-19 pandemic. But the City of Marfa also implemented COVID-19 precautions in their permit, requiring a COVID-19 safety plan, an estimated time that local extras will need to be without masks for shooting purposes, and precautions to protect local extras from the spread of the virus. Sandwich boards around the set's perimeter informed locals a motion picture is filming here. Due to COVID-19 regulations, no visitors are allowed on set. They all got the permits. It seemed to go smoothly, said Eugene Binder, whose gallery was being used as a backdrop as well as a staging area on the interior. These people are pros, so to my knowledge, it all went smoothly, he said. The location's manager told Binder that permitting with the City of Marfa went smoothly. Chelsea Smith, the City Secretary of Marfa, noted that another new provision of the ordinance would have crews notify neighbors and have them sign off on filming in their area. The crew also had a person designated to monitor COVID precautions, according to Smith. They have a COVID person on staff who is doing checks, making sure they are washing hands, taking care of distancing, screening people for symptoms, asking them questions, Rowan said. And although masks have to come off when the cameras roll, they're doing a good job mitigating any issues.
Hello, this is Sonia reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, July 30th, 2020. Bank building to become Airbnb bar. Valadez buy site from EDC by Sandra Sadek. Downtown Fort Stockton will see a bar and Airbnb on Main Street after local attorney Albert Valadez purchased the former bank building at 123 North Main Street from the Fort Stockton Economic Development Corporation at its July 28 meeting. Valadez purchased the former bank building at 123 North Main Street and plans to convert it into a bar and an Airbnb, according to EDC Director Remy Ramos. Valadez paid the EDC $55,200. The Fort Stockton EDC is excited to continue to help develop downtown Fort Stockton, Ramos said. I look forward to working with these businesses as well as existing businesses in the downtown area to create a destination area for locals and visitors. The building has been vacant since the police department moved the dispatch center to its new building, 1710 North Front Street, earlier this year. Valadez could not be reached for comment by the Pioneer's print deadline. Counteroffer. The EDC made a counteroffer for another downtown building, 507 North Main Street, to Glitzy Trends, LLC. A day spa is being considered for the site, according to the EDC. Sales tax deadline. Local sales taxes for the month of May showed a 13.51% decrease compared to same time last year. In May 2019, sales tax revenues were $407,761.17 versus May 2020 revenues showing $352,658.14, according to Ramos. Grant denied. Elida Cabella, owner of Tiny Tots Learning Center, appealed the EDC's denial of her application for the Fort Stockton EDC COVID-19 Small Business Relief Grant. Her application was denied because her daycare is considered essential. Therefore, it had the opportunity to remain open for business under state and local government guidelines. However, Cabella claimed she had to close her business because she could not meet CDC guidelines to safely operate. I feel discriminated against because I don't pay sales tax, Cabella said. Y'all might not approve me, and that's okay. You all need to kind of keep in mind what services do we need here in Fort Stockton, and all our businesses are very important to continue growing. Her appeal was denied by the EDC, which noted that making an exception for the daycare would leave the corporation vulnerable to be flexible with other businesses in the city. A deviation outside of this version 2.0 guide does not open us only to serve other daycares, but now it opens us to serve everything that is not included in the guidelines, Ramos said. County enacts burn ban by Sandra Sadek. The Pecos County Commissioner's Court passed an order prohibiting outdoor burning for 90 days during their July 27 meeting. The burn ban went into effect on July 27 and will run through October 25th. It limits outdoor burning activities to those related to public health and safety that are authorized by the Texas Natural Resources Commission. This includes firefighter training, public utility, natural gas pipeline, or mining operations. Planting or harvesting of crops or burns that are conducted by a prescribed burn manager certified under Section 153.048 of the Natural Resources Code and that meets the standards of Section 153.047 of the Natural Resources Code. Violation of the order could result in a Class C misdemeanor, punishable with a fine up to $500. Right now, the index level is at 545. It's above average, Jesse Dominguez, Pecos County Emergency Management Coordinator and Deputy Sheriff said. Once it gets over 300 to 400, that's when it starts to get really dry. In other action, the commissioners approved an interlocal agreement for TIPS membership, a national purchasing cooperative for Xerox copiers and printers purchased by Pecos County. Approved an agreement with the Texas Department of Transportation for the County Transportation Infrastructure Fund Grant Program amounting to $4,513,599. Purchased an air compressor with equipment for sandblasting for Precinct 4 with budgeted funds totaling $19,995. Took no action on a request for Precinct 4 to purchase a riding mower with a grass catcher. Approved the minutes of the previous meeting on July 13, 2020. The Pecos County Commissioners Court meets the second and fourth Monday at 10 a.m. in the Pecos County Courthouse. The meeting is live streamed on the Fort Stockton Pioneers Facebook page. Store faces permanent closure. The inability of Stage Stores to find a buyer amid a bankruptcy filing means the Bell's store in Fort Stockton may permanently close instead of reopening under the Gordman's brand name. The store at 1700 West Dickinson Boulevard started a going-out-of-business sale back in October 2019. At the time, the plan was for the store, along with other Bell stores nationally, to reopen in spring 2020 under the Gordman's brand name. However, store closings and a downturn in business tied to the COVID-19 pandemic forced Bell's parent company, Stage Stores, to file Chapter 11 bankruptcy in May. Stage Stores also filed a notice of sales process with the U.S. District and Bankruptcy Court for the Southern District of Texas Houston Division. The company is looking to sell the business or its assets. If a buyer is found, the store has a chance to remain open. Otherwise, it will permanently close, according to employees. Stage Stores owns and operates locations in 42 states under the Bell's, Goody's, Palais Royal, Peebles, Gordman's, and Stage Stores names. Last year, Stage Stores announced it would be transitioning most of its Bell stores into Gordman's, a discount retail chain founded more than 100 years ago. In its bankruptcy filing, Stage said it owes between $500 million and $1 billion to more than 10,000 creditors, including Nike, Skechers, Ralph Lauren, Levi Strauss, and Adidas. The company reported $1.58 billion in annual revenue in 2018. This is a very difficult announcement, and it was a decision that we reached only after exhausting every possible alternative, Stage Stores President and Chief Executive Officer Michael Glazer said in a statement. Over the last several months, we had been taking significant steps to attempt to strengthen our financial position and find an independent path forward. However, the increasingly challenging market environment was exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic, which required us to temporarily close all of our stores and furlough the vast majority of our associates. Given these conditions, we have been unable to obtain necessary financing and have no choice but to take these actions, the statement continued. Stage Stores can trace its beginnings to the 1920s, when Bell's and Palais Royal were founded. Stage Stores acquired Gordman's in 2017, when the discount retail company filed for bankruptcy. Miracle Worker opens August 7. Ragweed Joe moved to 2021. The newly remodeled Nelson Street Theater will host its first production with William Gibson's play, The Miracle Worker, on August 7 to 11. Reservations are required by calling 432-336-3180 by noon on performance day. This will allow for social distancing each performance, and the audience must wear masks. Tickets will be paid at the door and are available only for those who reserved seating. Tickets cost $15 for adults and $10 for students and seniors ages 65 plus. The Fort Stockton Community Theater Group also announced that the production of the melodrama Ragweed Joe will be moved to June 2021 due to the number of cast members and the singing involved during the COVID-19 restrictions. The cast is large and there is singing, which is hard to do through a mask, wrote Alice Dirksen in a press release from the FSCT. Meanwhile, the FSCT is moving forward with The Miracle Worker, which has a smaller cast and no singing. The play will be the first staged at the new Nelson Street Theater, which underwent a $2 million expansion and remodel. The Miracle Worker tells the true story of Annie Sullivan's work in teaching Helen Keller, who was deaf, blind, and mute, back in the 19th century. The play was first staged in 1959, 2 years after being performed on television. It was later made into a movie that won 2 Academy Awards in 1962. The FSCT production is being directed by Dirksen and assisted by Suzanne Hall. The cast includes Sadie Hall as Helen Keller, Jordan Ward as Annie Sullivan, Jody Day as Kate Keller, Michael Logan as Captain Keller, Garrett Huckabee as James Keller, Seth Hall as Dr. Agognos, Anna Nix as Martha, Silas Hall as Percy, Penny Smith as Aunt Ev, and Gail Lampier as Viney. The crew includes Jay Stroud, Aria Rojas, William Garrison, and Susan Hall. Lights and sound are being coordinated by J.B. Gallegos and Justice Hall. FSISD, City at Odds Over SRO Deals Wording, by Sandra Sadek. The Fort Stockton ISD School Board delayed voting on an interlocal agreement with the City of Fort Stockton to provide school resource officers, SROs, over a disagreement in wording. At the board's July 28 meeting, Superintendent Ralph Trainum also gave updates on changes in instruction due to COVID-19 for the upcoming school year. SROs. The interlocal agreement to provide SROs was held up over the accountability of the officers, according to Trainum. The city wants officers to be subjected to Section 2.14 of the City Employee Manual in the case of removing or replacing an officer. However, Trainum said the officers should be district employees, therefore subjected to district employment guidelines rather than those of the city. Right now, it's the only hiccup. Either side didn't really have any problems with any other area, Trainum said. I understand the city's side. They're asking for what they feel like they need, but school districts are different. Trainum said the biggest concern he had with the officers being city employees is the possibility of legal action against the district by SRO who feel they were wrongfully removed or replaced from the position. If we're asking for an SRO to be removed and the SRO is removed and becomes disgruntled, then you have a disgruntled employee. It's not our employee, it's the city's employee, but they still possibly could file legal action and say they were wrongfully removed, Trainum said. I don't want to go through that, and that's what our attorney is saying, that we have to handle these kinds of situations a certain way. The police department provided 2 SROs last year. The need for the officers ended in March when the district campuses shut down due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The current district standard is to call the police department should there be an emergency on campus. School Board President Billy Espino said that regardless of who employs the SRO, their responsibility will be the same. Many board members agreed that the agreement needs to be done as soon as possible to ensure the safety of students on campus. This should have already been resolved, said Sandra Marquez, board member. Let's work together. This is not a game to be playing around with our kids. The board is hoping to have a final draft to vote on by its next meeting. Background. The City of Fort Stockton and the school district signed off on a deal for police to provide the SROs, with the district paying a portion of the cost. The agreement was in effect from August 1, 2018 to July 31, 2019. That agreement included a 1-year extension unless a written termination was issued. The council approved an agreement at its December 17, 2019 meeting, but it was never approved by the FSISD. At the time, the police had 2 SROs and were flexing other staff to help at the schools due to shortages in hiring another 3 SROs, according to minutes from the meetings. Unable to reach a formal agreement for the 2019-2020 school year, the extension was exercised, according to Fort Stockton City Manager Frank Rodriguez. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic-driven school closures, police stopped providing SROs in March at the request of the district, Rodriguez said. The city sent the district a letter on May 1st terminating the original agreement, thus eliminating the window to operate on another extension. Trainum recommended that the district create its own police department, but the idea deadlocked on a 3-3 vote on June 8 and then was rejected on a 4-2 vote June 22nd. The rejection resulted in the district reopening talks with the city. Class update. Updates on how classes will be taught this academic year were provided by the superintendent. For August, all classes will be held virtually. Following the initial 4 weeks of remote instruction, the district will assess the situation and decide whether to return to in-person instruction or remain remote. If the district decides to remain remote, the board will have to pass a waiver extending virtual instruction for another 4 weeks. However, the campuses will remain open for students and parents who may need the school resources and services. To accommodate the need for technological access, the district has purchased computers ahead of the technology commitment proposed in the 2019 bond. The Texas Education Agency will be matching the district's purchase. For every $1,000 spent by the district, the agency will pay $500. It'll help the school district be able to provide remote learning for our students, the ones that are staying home, and in case there are shutdowns in the future, the superintendent said in his report. County's active COVID-19 cases at 14. After seeing its active COVID-19 cases reach 22 last week, Pecos County has seen its numbers drop into the teens this week. As of July 29, the county has 14 active cases. With laboratories taking longer to turn around test results amid an increase in testing, the county again saw new cases reported and listed as recovered on the same day. According to Pecos County Emergency Management Director Jesse Dominguez, as of July 28, the county had conducted 1,485 tests with 1,190 negative results, 125 tests pending, 124 positive tests from county residents, 46 positive tests from out-of-county residents tested here, 14 active local cases, 1 active out-of-county case, 1 death, 109 recoveries in-county, and 45 recoveries out-of-county. Among the recoveries this past week was a 75-year-old Pecos County man who was hospitalized in El Paso due to COVID-19, has now left the hospital and is recovered, according to Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster. The man was listed as case number 75. He tested positive in El Paso. Governor Greg Abbott's mandatory mask order is still in effect. The county would have to go 30 days with fewer than 20 active cases to again be exempted. The governor's mask requirement allows law enforcement to issue a warning on the first violation and up to a $250 fine for each additional violation. No one can be arrested for not wearing a mask. People do not have to wear a mask while exercising outdoors unless they are with a group, when driving, or when at home, unless around people who don't live at the house. TDCJ. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice, which operates two sites in Fort Stockton, reports its numbers separately. Inmate cases do not count toward a county's total, while those among staff do. According to the TDCJ site, there is one active case and one person in medical isolation among inmates at the N5 unit, 1536 East I-10. To date, 68 inmates have recovered from COVID-19. No active cases are reported among the N5 staff, which has 20 recoveries. No active cases have been reported at the Linau unit, 1098 South Highway 2037.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, July 30th. Managers approve purchase of new lab equipment to speed COVID testing. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Ward Memorial Hospital Board of Managers agreed to purchase new lab equipment that will speed up COVID-19 testing, as well as results of other, more routine blood tests. The managers agreed to the purchase in last Thursday's meeting. The machine from CFID Technologies will return most test results in about an hour, including sample preparation. CEO Leticia Rodriguez said the machine will process up to 4 samples simultaneously. The cost of the new equipment was quoted as nearly $59,000, and delivery can be made in about 2 months. Quote, since the machine can be used for COVID testing, it can be paid for from the COVID funds and not the regular hospital equipment budget, Rodriguez said. In other actions, the managers approved a new dietary consultant agreement. The TCDRS rate, and the new health insurance rate. The dietary consultant agreement with Tobia Ross, registered dietitian, is a renewal of a previous agreement that will continue to be a liaison with the medical and nursing staff, as well as providing in-service programs for the hospital employees as needed. The work includes approving menus provided by the hospital. Cost of the agreement is $650 per month and $70 per hour in excess of 8 hours per month, and the consultant will be paid $100 in travel expense for each round trip to the hospital. The retirement agreement with Texas County and District Retirement System for 2021 actually went down slightly from the 2020 agreement. The total ending rate dropped from 9.27% to 9.25%. Highlights of the plan include a 7% employee deposit rate with employer matching. Retirement eligibility can be at age 60 with 8 years of service or the rule of 75, which is the age of employee plus the years of service adding up to 75, or at any age with 30 years of service. The cost of employee health insurance for 2021 increased by about 4.5%. The total cost of the new agreement is $54,000 over 2020. Quote, as we have done in the past, I recommend that we do not pass the cost increases onto our employees. It is a great help in employee retention. We have great benefits here, Rodriguez said. The managers agreed with Rodriguez and approved the plan with no increase to the employees. Although the hospital is an operating unit of Ward County, the TCDRS and employee health plans are not part of Ward County plans, and the hospital works as its own entity. State Representative Brooks Landgraf, a Republican from District 81, attended last Thursday's meeting via telephone for the first few minutes. Landgraf said, quote, the budget for the upcoming biannual will be smaller. Even with the current budget, we are looking at about 9% short. Hospitals and schools will be the priority. We realize the financial situation is critical for public entities. Quote, revenue streams of sales tax are down, and severance taxes from oil and gas are at a 50 to 60 year low. It will be a slow economic recovery with oil and gas demand lagging. Quote, Comptroller Glenn Hager is very conservative and hopes for the best and plans for the worst, end quote. Commissioners approve COVID pay for affected employees. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Meeting in regular session on Monday morning, the Ward County Commissioners approved items related to COVID-19. The commissioners voted to pay employees for COVID-19 related absences, approved a youth baseball tournament, and a teacher breakfast. A full-time hourly salaried and permanent part-time county employees will be paid for virus-related actions, subject to a statement from a physician or approval by employer. Part-time summer help will not be paid for any absences. A summer youth baseball tournament was okayed with the conditions that social distancing be maintained and face masks will be worn. The commissioners also approved a teacher breakfast at the Ward County Event Center if Monahan's wicked Pyote ISD wishes to do so. Details of the breakfast will be left to District 2 Commissioner Larry Hanna and Event Center Director Pablo Valles. The number of active COVID cases is now 12, below the mandated requirement of wearing face masks if active cases are over 20. Quote, "The mandate is still in place, as we would have to be below 20 for 30 consecutive days before we can again apply for an exemption. At least for now, the mandate remains in place," Judge Greg Holly said. Commissioners present were Tino Sanchez, Hanna, Dexter Nichols, and Eddie Nelms. No additional fees will be added to vehicle registration based on a unanimous vote of the court. According to the Texas Department of Motor Vehicles, the county has the option to add up to $10 for the county road and bridge fee, and up to $1.50 as a child safety fee to registration costs. As in past years, the commissioners voted to not add these optional fees to vehicle registration costs in 2021. The commissioners also approved donating the old Grand Falls Community Center to Grand Falls Royalty ISD with conditions. Ward County owns half of the mineral rights on that property, and that ownership will remain with the county. Secondly, if GRISD sells the property in less than 10 years, proceeds will go to the county. The county also reserves the right to use the center in emergency situations. The bid of $102,000 for the new roof at the Ward County Coliseum from Clayton Boyd Industries was approved. The new roof will match the new arena as closely as possible, including the addition of same-style cupolas. The commissioners approved the funding from the City of Monahans for the hotel and occupancy tax to help support the Ward County Event Center and the Million Barrel Museum. Monahan City Council had approved $400,000 for the Event Center and $50,000 for the museum, subject to availability. Quote, "The hotel and occupancy funds, along with rental fees for the use of the Event Center, generally cover the operational cost of the center, but with the COVID-19, that probably won't be the case this year," Holly said. Payment of bills totaling $2.5 million was approved unanimously. The commissioners acknowledged the 143rd Judicial District Court order setting the salary for County Auditor Ellen Fryer. Her salary will be $96,000 for 2021. At the request of librarian Brenda Kizier, a resolution changing the policies for the library in Monahans was approved. The primary change establishes eligibility for patrons obtaining a library card. The new policy will require a 90-day probation period with no late fees, notices, or fines before a card will be issued. Quote, "Last year, we lost about 2,600 books from the library to people who left the county," Kizier said. A resolution concerning a grant agreement with Texas Department of Transportation was also approved. The grant provides Ward County with funds of $5.1 million from TxDOT, with the county matching $1.29 million. Quote, "We're getting over $6 million in services for an investment of a little over $1 million. It's a great deal for the county," Holly said. A request from Norfleet Land Services, LLC, to cross County Roads 149 and 160 was approved. The request is to drill horizontally for a 42-inch natural gas pipeline under each road that will be cathodically protected and buried a minimum of 5 feet below the surface of the road. County Roads 149 and 160 are located north of Barstow. In routine matters, minutes of the July 13th and county officers' reports were approved. The next meeting will be held on August 10th at 9:30 a.m. in the Commissioner's Courtroom of the Ward County Courthouse. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Monahans News on July 30th. Evelyn Fay Beasley Harkey Peden, known as Billy to her friends and family, went to be with the Lord on July 21st in Tulsa, Oklahoma. She was 90 years old. She was met in heaven by her first husband, Ira Delman Harkey, her son, Wendell Neal Harkey, and many other family members. She was born on August 9, 1929, in McKamey, Texas, to Annie Nicholas and Louis Beasley. She was raised by her loving mother and her stepfather, Annie and L.T. Glover. She lived in many different places throughout her life and attended Alpine High School in Alpine, Texas. It was there that she met Ira Delman Harkey. They were married on October 15, 1947. Together, they made their home in Monahans and raised four children, Delman, Wendell, Jackie, and Darla. Her husband passed away in 1981. She then married Thomas K. Peden on January 14, 1983. Together, they celebrated 37 years of marriage. In 1992, they moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma. She was preceded in death by her first husband, Ira Delman Harkey, her son, Wendell Neal Harkey, her parents, L.T. and Annie Glover, as well as her brother, Jack Beasley, and sister, Wilma Nell Ford. She is survived by her husband, Thomas K. Peden of Tulsa, Delman Harkey and wife Jane of Georgetown, Texas, Jackie Harkey and wife Judy of Odessa, daughter Darla Presley and husband Dave of Tulsa, and Christine Peden Berry and husband Rich of Euless, Texas. She's also survived by 8 grandchildren. She also survived by 21 great-grandchildren and 2 great-great-grandchildren. Visitation was at Schott's funeral service in Tulsa on Thursday, July 22nd. Due to COVID-19, there were no services in Tulsa. She was brought to Monahans for burial. Graveside services were held Saturday, July 25th, at Monahans Memorial Cemetery, with Reverend Dave Dunson officiating. Judy Ann Scatz Owen went to be with the Lord on July 19th. She was born to Bina Lou and Edward Scatz on August 13, 1949, in Hollis, Oklahoma. She was a devout Christian and loved her church family. She is survived by her husband, Ira Owen of Lubbock, a son, Ira Buster Owen II of Lubbock, an adopted son, Jose Olguin of Grand Falls, a daughter, Loretta Owen of Lubbock, 9 grandchildren, 8 of Lubbock and 1 of Grand Falls, and 10 great-grandchildren, all of Lubbock. She is also survived by a brother, Ernie Scatz, and a sister, Linda Wilkins, both of Hollis, Oklahoma, a sister, Darlene and Kenneth Stallings of Big Spring. She is also survived by many nieces, nephews, and in-laws. She was preceded in death by a daughter, Maretta Owen, sister Carol Motes, and her parents. Memorial services were held Saturday, July 25th, at South Park Baptist Church, located on 2201 82nd Street at 2 p.m. Council moves forward on raising bulk water rates. The story was written by Smokey Briggs. Bulk water sales, the budget for the Monahans Economic Development Corporation, and appointing an alternate member to the Planning and Zoning Board were the only items on the agenda for the Monahans City Council during its regularly scheduled 3 p.m. meeting Tuesday at City Hall. The Council approved the first reading of Ordinance Number 1279 pertaining to bulk water sales. The amendment will raise the price of water sold for non-potable purposes to $13.50 per 1,000 gallons and, if approved after a second reading, will go into effect on October 1, 2020. The new rate is about a 35% increase and should provide the city with anywhere from $20,000 to $50,000 in additional revenue compared to sales for the past year, City Manager Rex Thee said. Thee told the council that the water was treated water from the city's well field and that it was primarily used for industry such as cement plants, road construction, and also in the oil field. During the 2018-2019 fiscal year, the city sold 30 million gallons to bulk buyers. In comparison, the city pumped a total of 697 million gallons of water in total, with a little less than half, 296 million, being for residential use. Another 120 million gallons was used by businesses, and 132 million gallons was supplied to the Southwest Sandhills Water Supply Cooperative that supplies water to rural customers in Ward County. After selling more than 30 million gallons last year, the city has only sold about 5 million gallons this year. Executive Director for the Monahans Economic Development Corporation, Ashley Adato, was on hand to brief the council regarding her proposed budget for the coming fiscal year. Adato explained the MEDC board had approved the budget in an earlier meeting. Since MEDC is primarily financed through sales tax revenue collected through the city, the council has final say regarding the budget. This year's proposed budget shaved right at $500,000 off of last year's budget, with a total price tag of $1.9 million, compared to last year's $2.4 million. The budget foresees MEDC's share of sales tax monies to drop by $100,000 to $200,000 and forecasts about $500,000 less in projected expenses in the coming year. The council approved the budget. Last, after meeting for 5 minutes in executive session, the council reconvened in open session and appointed Rudy Sesteda as an alternate member of the Planning and Zoning Board of Adjustment. Sesteda was a longtime employee of the city who recently retired from the Water Department. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Monahans News on July 23rd. Henry Clinton Hank Holland passed away at home on July 18th at the age of 69. Hank was born in Monahans on January 6, 1951. He was preceded in death by his mother, Clinton May McBride Holland, and his father, Claude Ward Holland. He spent most of his life in Monahans, first working for his father at Holland Electrical Services, then as the owner. He is survived by his wife, Linda McDaniel of Monahans, and his two sisters, Claudia Carraway of San Angelo and Christy Kessler of San Antonio. He will be forever missed and loved, but never forgotten. A memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Monday, July 27th, at Harkey Funeral Home Chapel, with Billy Riley officiating. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guest book or leave a personal note for the family. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. Larry Hall, age 70, of Monahans, passed away on July 19th in his home in Monahans. Larry was born in San Diego, California, to John Hall and Hilda Vitale. He was a floor-covering journeyman most of his life and graduated from Technical College in refrigeration and air conditioning. He is preceded in death by his daughters, Sherry and Christina Hall, and his wife of 42 years, Barbara Hall. He is survived by son, Larry Hall II, and daughter-in-law, Nitza Hall, Raymond and Linda O'Gean, and Jennifer Corey, all from Monahans. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guest book or leave a personal note for the family. On Saturday, July 4th, in her hometown of Abilene, Nancy Eleanor Tucker Jordan passed away peacefully at the age of 84. She was born on May 14th, 1936, to H. Leo and Leela May Tucker in Abilene. Nancy married Carrie Dalvin Jordan of Carlsbad, New Mexico, on August 23rd, 1958. The couple spent 62 years together until her passing. From 1961 to 1993, each of them served in some capacity of Texas public education in Kerrville, Waxahachie, Brownwood, West, Alpine, and Monahans. Nancy is survived by her husband, G. Dalvin Jordan of Monahans, three sons, Will Henry Hank Jordan of Abilene, Scott T. Jordan of Lafayette, Louisiana, and Carlton R. Jordan of Melissa. Four grandchildren, Jake Jordan of Belton, Clayton Jordan of Paris, Mary Margaret Jordan and Christopher Jordan of Melissa, and five great-grandchildren. A private service for immediate family was held on Sunday, July 12th, at McBee Cemetery in Ovalo, the final resting place for many of her ancestors.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.